Good morning, everyone. It's wonderful to see all of your shining faces. For those who might not know, I've been gone for about 3 weeks. As a matter of fact, last Sunday, at this very time, I was in India with Swamiji. And I spent those 3 weeks in India with Swamiji. That was my purpose for going. I went down and I had to get my visa, and they, you know, it's a tourist visa. And many of the times when those of us who are devotees go to India, we go on pilgrimage and we visit all the shrines. But my specific goal was to go on a little tiny pilgrimage from the ashram where I was living, down the street, around the corner, across the field, over the ditch, into the gate, and into Swami's house. And I managed to get there at a time when that was possible. I had no idea what to expect. So I thought today, because we're talking about the light in the presence of darkness, or in the presence of ignorance, that's the perfect metaphor for Swami and me. He's such a shining light, and India is at this time coming into his light. And so I thought I would share with you what I could about what I saw and what I felt and what I heard and mostly what I experienced. I was there at actually a very historic time. As many of you know, Swami has been working on the masterpiece of his life. Of all the books that he has written, this is the one that he said over and over again, both in private conversations and in the public venue. He said, "This is the book that Master asked me to write. And this is the book that is going to bring thousands of people to God." And he said, and I wrote it. He said, when I started writing it, I thought it was going to be a slim volume. And he brought down the preface that he had written. And he said, and I have to change that. Because right in front of my very eyes, it grew. And on the coffee table in the living room, there was a stack of papers about this high, maybe higher. And it was the manuscript. And he said, 632 pages. He's exclaiming at this. And he says, I did it in 2 months. He said, it took me a year and a half to edit the path. And then he said, but I didn't do it. He said, he did it. And I asked him, I said, well, what was that like to write this opus that Master had charged you with doing? And that goes all the way back to his time at 29 Palms with Master. At one point, Master said to him, edit strongly, but or go like lightning, but don't change a thing. And Swami said, you know, he just wanted me to get the feel. He just wanted me to be exposed at that time. And he said, then it took a whole lifetime of me teaching and living this scripture, because it is a scripture, before I could actually be ready to receive it. And it was an experience of receptivity more than it was an experience of creativity. And he was very clear about that in speaking with us. I said to him, well, sir, did you have to write into the night? Because he would come down in the morning. We would show up about 10 or 11 o'clock, and we'd come into the front door and go through the atrium. It would be very quiet. And then we'd move into the living room and we'd find the page where we had left off the day before and start reading. And I was behind everybody. It became a joke because I had just kind of poured myself onto the plane, not having had a chance to read anything before I left. And he would come down, he said, Helen, how far are you? And I would say, for many days, I never got past page 30. And he said, you're not even at the Bhagavad Gita. And I felt so remiss. But I said, Swami, I'm not missing a word. And so we would be in there, and he would come down, and he would say, I'm very tired this morning. This body is very tired. And he might go on. I mean, day after day, he would say, my heart feels tired. Or he would say, he would reference some of the many ailments that are challenging him and have challenged him for a long, long time, not the least of which is full-fledged diabetes. And we would be sitting there, and Miriam, his nurse would come in and he'd be talking. He'd say, "Oh, it's that time again." And he'd stand up and then she'd give him a shot 4 times a day of insulin. Or one day he went to the doctor and he had a cortisone shot in his shoulder to take care of the bursitis that he's suffering from. He says, "You know, I just can't lift this arm past there." And I have suffered from that, knew exactly what he was talking about. And there are complications, because when you get cortisone, then it makes your blood sugar go up, which is terrible for the diabetes. And, you know, you're kind of in this netherland for 4 or 5 days. So these were real challenges. And he would say, "You know, I'm a little tired today." And I'd say, "Well, sir, when you were working on this," and he never stopped the whole time I was there. He edited all 3 weeks. I said, "Did you have to work into the night?" And he said, "Oh, yes." I said, "So how much sleep did you get?" He said, "Oh, my usual, 2, 3, 4 hours. And I would watch him sitting there. And to go back to the operating metaphor, it was a beacon of energy and light that never let up. Some days he would say, "Well, it's time for me to go take my nap." And then we would come back in the afternoon. And he would say, "So, what time did I go up for my nap?" "Oh, yes," he said, "I never made it." He would get sidetracked. Lakshman, his secretary, would come in and something would have happened with the script. And so he would just take care of that, or he would get an email. But throughout all of this activity, there was this mind and soul and body that was so receptive to the grace that Master was sending, that flowed through him and expressed in this scripture. And that many of you heard Asha read excerpts from it at Christmas time, I understand. And many of you have gone over to Asha and David's house and read on your own. So you know whereof I speak. But I'll just tell it from my point of view. And we would sit there. I had two traveling companions. Many of you know them, Seva and Nidruva, and I see James is here. James was over there at the same time I was there. And we would sit there, all of us at different parts of the commentaries. And the title is Commentaries of the Bhagavad Gita by Paramhansa Yogananda as remembered by his disciple, Swami Kriyananda. And Swami said, "This is what I remember. This is the summation of my life's experience. And this is what, when I go into meditation, Master gives me. And I write it down." And he said, "There were only 2 times when I wasn't sure about the commentary. And I just prayed, and then it came, and I knew it was true. I knew it was true." And that's what I knew too when I was reading it. This was true. Every single commentary just sparkled with light and truth and practicality. And that was a theme that came up over and over again with Swami, both in our wonderfully intimate, and believe me, this was such a gift from God. Nothing I've ever deserved, nothing I've ever done in my life makes me deserve this. But just those intimate moments that I had over and over again with him and a few others in his living room or out and about, whatever it was. Over and over again, I was struck by the practicality of everything in that manuscript. And he emphasized that. He emphasized it to the great big audiences that he had, because there were many public programs that happened during this time. It was Christmas time, and you think, well, Christmas in India, but I can tell you, they had their Christmas trees, and they had their ornaments, and they had their gifts out in the malls. In his house, which is so beautifully appointed, his aesthetic sense, his sense of beauty, his sense of truth as it expresses in color and shape and form is exquisite. So you walk into his house, and Leela was telling me, Leela is the cook in the house and a dear friend. She was saying, "You know, we took a little plant over in the corner and we put lights and ornaments on it. And we thought that was beautiful." And it was actually beautiful. I saw the plant and I thought to myself, "Oh, that's lovely." Then Swami would come down and he'd say, "Yeah." And then he'd say, "So, where's the Christmas tree?" And Swami, this is the Christmas tree, they would say. Oh, fine, fine. And then somebody would be going out, and it might be Leela, or it might be Nirmala, or Dharmadas, and he'd say, are they going to get the Christmas tree? And they didn't. And as the days worked up towards Christmas, finally Leela says to me, I finally got the point. We needed to get a Christmas tree. So Nirmala went out to find the Christmas tree. Now, of course, it's India, and there are no Christmas trees. Not real ones. But they got a beautiful, lovely one, and they decorated it all with gold and red ornaments and lights. And they put it right there in the middle of the living room. We were going to have a satsang at Christmas Eve, and some of the Indian families were coming who were very close to the work there. And Nirmala was moving furniture. This is why I didn't get a lot read. Because when you sat in that living room and you tried to do your homework, which is what I felt like I was doing, even though it was a joy to do this kind of homework, you got involved. So Nirmala's moving furniture, and I'm helping her move the furniture. And she says, I think we should move the Christmas tree out of the way. And then Swami walked in the door and said, the Christmas tree stays in the center of the room. And there it stayed, and he was so right. He just knew that it would energize that entire gathering of Indians and American devotees who came on Christmas Eve night just to be with him, to have their Divine Mother gift exchange, just like we do here, and to be in the light. So, you know, there are layers to this experience that I'm having. There's the Gita commentaries that are so profound. There's Swami, who's coming in and over and over again addressing certain themes that are his favorite, that he thinks of as very important at that moment. And one of the themes that he came up to again and again, he brought it up to us, was moksha and liberation. And he said, can you believe that none of the other religions teach moksha? And he said, it's not that the avatars didn't teach it. It's not that Jesus didn't talk about liberation, Moses, Buddha, Krishna, Mohammed. He said, it's that the disciples mangled it as generation to generation to generation, and it got lost. He said, Hinduism is the only religion in the world that actually held on to that concept. And he said, that's what makes Hinduism so important in this evolution as we go into Dwapara Yuga on the advancing mode. He said, that's what makes it so important. He said, because there's an understanding that's embedded deep in the culture, deep in the psyche, deep in the very soil. And he talked about getting off the plane and experiencing the vibration that comes up out of the soil of India. And he said this to the Indians in his audiences, once in Calcutta, once in the community center at Gurgaon when we were celebrating Master's birthday. And he just said, India has a role to play that is absolutely indispensable. And he said, and you are the players. And you could see how they took this in and how they understood from some visceral level that goes way back beyond this lifetime, that goes way deep into the soil, that they understand moksha as the primary goal of life. And they understand the role of the avatar, and they understand the role of a Swamiji, like our Swamiji, who comes and says, I have been sent, I was told by my guru, that there is a great work to be done and that I have a great work to do. And this is the culmination of it. Everything has led up to this particular moment in my evolution as a soul, in my lifetime, and in yours. And you could see that, just drink that in. Now, at the same time, where he was acknowledging the tremendous role that India has to play in conjunction with America Because he went back, he took it back through the entire lineage of gurus. You know, there was Lahiri, who prevailed upon Babaji to agree that Kriya could be given to more, excuse me, than just those who were advanced enough to renounce everything. And to our benefit, right? But, and then Lahiri trains Yukteswar, and Yukteswar waits until Yogananda comes, and he's the one, and he's the one who's going to go to America. And he sends him off. Yogananda has that vision where he says, those must be Americans. And do you know, within hours, he was gone. He had turned over the role that he had at Ramji, the school, and he was gone to America to do his master's mission. And then he waits. And then along comes Walter, and J. Donald Walters, and he becomes the disciple. And he says to him, Walter, you have a great work to do. Swami came back to this over and over again with his Indian audiences. And the lineage of gurus is something that they really can take and at face value and understand. And then at the same time, there are sacred cows in any culture. And he just did not hold back when he would say very strong, strong things about, for example, the caste system. And he said, you know, the caste system is absolutely right when you approach it from the point of view in which it was originally intended, as states of consciousness that all of us have within us, one of which may be ascendant. He said, but somehow or another, it got distorted into a birthright. And he said, and that's when it all went wrong. You know, you'd read the papers. I read the papers while I was there. And there are references to caste systems and people who belong to a certain lower caste and horrible things that happen and things that happen to women and whose families can't come up with dowries and so forth and so on. Still happening in India. Swami just made no bones about that. And he talked about family, another just cherished institution in India. All the homes that you see, the ones that we rent or have bought, I had the good fortune to be invited to the home of some educators, and I'll tell you that a little bit. But all those homes are structured to accommodate multi-generational families in the same home. And because they live together, the fathers, the mothers, the children, the grandparents live together. And Swami made very strong statements about true family is spiritual family. And biological and spiritual family oftentimes are not at the same level. And I watched those Indians in the audience. And he said, the real answer is communities. And this is nothing new. We've heard him say this to us a million times. But he's saying it in a different place. It's just when he went to Italy and he talked about communities, children leaving their families to go live in communities. I mean, that was heresy. So very powerful, clear expressions of his understanding and expression of Master's work in India are taking place as we speak. And the soil there is thirsty for it. People came. Now, that's the formal kind of level. That's the Swami speaking. And I can tell you that the body came into it. When we were in Calcutta, he was very sick. And yet he had this public talk to give. And he was sick all the way up to the moment that he went on stage. And then he walked across the stage, and I happened to know the background because I was privy, being in his house with him, I was privy to the health challenges. And he walked on stage, and here was the microphone, and he planted his feet, and he never moved them for an hour and a half. Not an inch, not that much. And he stood in his usual posture with his heart and chest forward and his shoulders back. And he just looked at his audience, and you could see, this is how I experienced it. It was as if his radar were revolving. He started out, he didn't know where he was going to go. He went here, and he went there, and here, and there, and all of a sudden, you begin to see that he's hitting everybody in the audience, one by one. And he's saying something that will apply to them. If they're young, he speaks to that. If they're old, he speaks to that. If they're married, yes. Monastic, yes. Whatever it happens to be, he had something to say. There wasn't a soul in that audience that could go away feeling like, well, he didn't cover my reality. And if you were on the path for 20, 30, 40 years, he spoke to that. If you had just come on the path and were worried because maybe you were a little older, he spoke to that. So it was such a virtuoso performance from a body that was definitely not on a scientific level, that probably wasn't up to it. And yet he did it. It reminded me of the time when Master was going to give a talk, but he had been very ill and couldn't walk. And he said, I'm playing out some karma for my disciples. And yet when he got to the place where he was going to talk, he got up and he walked in because he didn't want to be carried in. He gave the talk and then he couldn't use his legs again. And that's what this reminded me of. Because when Swami finished, an hour and a half later, he turned to walk off the podium and he tottered and Dharmadas was there to help him. He was not steady on his feet. And he says gaily, he says, "Don't ever get old." And everybody laughed. And then he stood as people walked out and he greeted every single person. And then he went home. And later he said to us, when we finally left Calcutta, he said, "I was so sick. But you know, what I experienced with Swami was, it doesn't matter what his body is doing. He's simply not identified with it. He's offering us an example of a person who has all these challenges. And yet, if it's Master's will, he's going to do it." And that plays out in such beautiful little ways. We would go over there, he'd be tired. And then we would say, "Oh, well, we're going to leave now." And he wouldn't want us to leave. Because his whole orientation is to give, give, give to every soul who comes through there. And he gives lavishly. It's not like he's parsimonious with his energy. One day, we were there, and then we left, and then we get a call. "Come over, we're going to the mall." He loved to go to the mall. And we would have coffee, cappuccino at the barista, which is like Starbucks. And then we would go into the Wishing Tree, which is the Ananda store. And in the process, just going up the escalator, people would see him. He wears his Swami robes and his bare legs and sandals, bare feet and sandals. So people would see him, and they would stop and they would pranam at his feet. And he would give every single one a blessing. He would go by the luggage shop. And the man who is in charge of the luggage shop would come barreling out the door to pranam at Swami's feet and to greet him. And Swami would stop and greet him. He would go by the bookstore, or he would go in the bookstore, and everybody would come out and say, "Swamiji." Such tremendous appreciation, such tremendous respect for him. Not his personality, but for his soul, which is that stage where it just bursts out in this beacon of light. And that gets me back to the manuscript, because the manuscript is a beacon of light. And then we were reading it, and Naidruva would say, "Oh, Swami," she said, "you are so clear." And then Seva would say, "This is so practical." And then I would say, "This is so true." And what I came to understand was that in order to write that, he had to exemplify it. Each little passage he exemplified, he embodied in every single thing that he did. I never saw him lose his calm. Even when something happened on the very last day, the only thing he said was, "Hell's bells." And then he got up and took the manuscript to Lakshman and said, "Lakshman, is this really true?" And they worked it out. Even when Catherine showed up with her manuscript of Henry V, it's a bio that she's writing, and she had forgotten and had single-spaced it. Now, you cannot edit a single-space manuscript. I can tell you that from personal experience. I train my children in school. Don't ever give me anything that's single-spaced. And Swami just looked at that and he said, Catherine. And, you know, we had to do it all over again. We were standing out at the cab, just waiting to say goodbye to him as he was going to get in to go off on a three-week vacation, the very last morning I was there. And he was saying, well, let's go, let's go. And nobody was moving, and I finally understood why. Because Lakshman had been up all night getting that last manuscript done. And as he finally got people into the cabs, Lakshman comes out with this big manuscript and says, here it is, Swami. And there, off he went. Later on, I found out that they barely made their plane. But Swami wasn't concerned. He wasn't concerned. He has a sense of time and flow that is so unusual. Maybe not in India, when you look at the traffic there. I had two moments of faith. One was when I was in a rickshaw at rush hour at dusk. And there was a big intersection, and I thought, we're never going to make this. This is it. I'm going to have to leap off this rickshaw to safety. And the other was at the temple of in Dakshineswar, at the Kali temple, when in order to go onto the grounds, you have to take your shoes off, and so then you check them. And they were my only shoes. And there are hundreds of shoes just kind of laid out, and he gave me a little token with a number on it and put it in the heel of my shoes and then stacked other shoes on top of it, and I thought, I'll never see them again. You know, but it did. And, you know, it's that kind of consciousness that Swami exemplifies all of the time. Whether it's going up into the mall or when we walked into an Italian restaurant, we took him out to lunch one day. And by that time, if I hadn't seen another Indian meal for a little while, because I love Indian food, but I was ready for something else. So we went to a place called Tonino's. And we walk in and everybody scurries. And all of a sudden you hear Swami's music playing over the... and you know, the owners come out and they talk to him. I mean, everywhere he goes, there's just this connection, and it's a heart connection. It's just such an example, such a model of how we can live our lives if we could but decide to. I mean, I loved the affirmation this morning. You know, I will decide to be happy from now on. Let's decide to be happy. He did. And he's living it out for us. That's one of his greatest gifts. Now, another part of my experience was Calcutta. And I wasn't going to go to Calcutta, but at the last minute, Swami decided to go to Calcutta. Now, that was historic because it was the first pilgrimage for Indians. Always before, it's been Americans. And now, there is enough energy for that to happen with Indians. So I got to go with all these Indians. And it was a marvelous, marvelous experience, close up with those devotees that are being drawn to this work. And I can tell you that they're sterling. I mean, you can't be on an overnight train with people, and I was sick as a dog, without really getting to know them. I was in the upper berth, flat on my back, fever, you know, shivering. I was just really in bad shape. And I would have to leap out and run to the bathroom every now and then. Opposite me was a multi-generational family in four berths. There was the grandma and the grandpa, the son, Chaitanya, his wife, and their little four-year-old daughter, Adya. And you know, this was one of those biological families that was in tune with each other and with this path. They had all received Kriya, and they were just, they're really the quintessential Indian devotee. Just all heart, all sweetness. The Indian men are so sweet with their children. I experience this with devotees on the path everywhere, the men. There's a sweetness that comes into them when they devote their lives to God. But with the Indians, it's even more so. So there we were, and this little girl was adorable. Not a problem. I thought to myself when I heard that children were coming on the pilgrimage, I thought, oh boy, this is going to be really interesting. But she was a delight. And we would entertain each other. She would do nursery rhymes. I would do nursery rhymes. That's when I was feeling better. Well, this the family scene was inspiring. We had an Indian couple that came from far away. They had stumbled upon the autobiography. They had read the autobiography. They said, this Kriya stuff sounds really good. Where can we get it? And they didn't know about Ananda. And then they stumbled on Ananda because Swami's being blasted all over on the TV programs. I mean, they're really national programs and people know who he is. They see him. And so they called, they found out about the pilgrimage, they came. Now, their son lives in Chicago. They operate a call center from wherever they are. It's not, it's, it might be Bangladesh. I think it is Bangladesh. And a call center that services the United States. It's just so interesting, you know, all of the little pieces are intertwined and coming together in a very real, delightful way. And so then they come, and they are so overjoyed to know that there is somebody here on this planet, that there are devotees on this planet who will help them realize what they read in the AY. That it's not just theory, that it's real, embodied with real people. And I thought to myself, you know, that's what happened with me on this trip too. Things came alive in a deeper, richer way than ever before for me. Going to Calcutta, I hadn't planned to do it. I did do it. I got to walk in the footsteps of the masters. And it was just a tiny little pilgrimage. We didn't go all over. We went to Master's house. We went to Tulsi Bose's house. We went to the temple at Dakshineswar. We went to Serampore, where Sri Yukteswar was. I got to dip my feet in the water. But, you know, you walk up those stairs at Four Goparwal Road, and you realize Master walked up those stairs. Everybody who's been on a pilgrimage I know knows this. You sit in his meditation room and you feel those vibrations. You meet the family. So it's not a museum. It's a living, real, rich experience of Master and the legacy that he has given to us. And everything came alive to me. I'll never be able to come up here and turn around and look at those pictures in the same way. They want to leap off the page at me. Yukteswar lives in my mind, in a way, and in my heart. So does Lahiri, more than they ever did before. So the power of pilgrimage is marvelous. Add to that all of the other overlays that were going on at this particular time with the manuscript and the growing Indian devotee population in India. And then there's one last little piece, and that was education for life. Now, you know, as the principal here of Living Wisdom School, when I went there, people had some expectations, which I didn't realize. They wanted me to connect with Indian educators. And I was certainly willing to do that, but I didn't, I hadn't expected it. So then days go by and days go by, and finally the last week, suddenly it's beginning to happen. And I met a family of educators who are devotees who wanted me to come and visit their school. Swami was thrilled. I mean, the level of his interest in every aspect of the work is remarkable. So I go to the school. It's about 2,000 children from K through 12. It's on the British system. And anybody who knows anything about education for life knows that there's probably a basic incompatibility with the British system and with our system of education. They don't recognize the importance of the spiritual development of a child in school. That's just not part of the equation. That is the basis of what we do. They also don't recognize the importance of joy in the learning process and the fact that a joyful learning process actually increases the learning, makes much more possible. So I'm there in this school and I'm talking to these educators and they're so proud of what they're doing and they're doing a beautiful job and they've read the book, EFL, and they actually think that they understand it. And then I walk into the classrooms and, you know, there's nothing there that tells me that they understand it. They're good people, dedicated people, wonderful teachers. The children are beautiful. But there's no aesthetic. You couldn't walk into a Living Wisdom school classroom without being immersed in the learning process on the walls, just what's on the walls. You should do that if you haven't. And you can't be in a Living Wisdom school classroom without understanding the tremendous freedom that the children have to express as unique souls. Because we give it to them. We encourage it in them. We require it in them. And then everything in the British system is regimented, and there's a great deal of rote. And it's just, you know, it's hard for me as an educator to see children have to go through that when in fact I know there's an alternative. And Swami wanted to know everything that I saw. So I told him, and he said, "That's terrible." and I said, "You know, Swamiji, I don't think they're going to, I don't think they really understand what they read in the book." He says, "Oh no," he says, "they wouldn't understand it." He says, "Helen, they have to get it by osmosis. They have to go and see. They have to come here." And they are. They're coming in the spring. And they're going to be here in Palo Alto, and they're going to be at the village. And I already know who I hope will be one of the EFL teachers. I want her to come with her daughter and all of that. But he was just so clear about that, and I know from my own experience that that is true. You can't get, it's a consciousness. Everything about this trip was about consciousness. Swami is about consciousness. And that's why when you come in front of him, he relates to each person individually, because he's relating to your consciousness. And there's something so tremendously validating about that, even when you're in trouble. You know? Because if your consciousness is off, you cannot afford to have a negative thought in Swami's presence. I had one, and I saw what the result was, and it's no fun. You know, it was just a passing thought. It was just, you know, I remembered something that happened years ago with one person when she happened to walk into the room. And it's not how I label her or anything like that. But I just saw Swami tune into that passing thought in that split second. And I thought, wow. You know, he has trained himself to be happy, to think positive, to see each one of us as sparks of the divine, to see our potential. And if we allow him to work with us, on whatever level we require to get us to the next step. And he's always positive. He said to me, he said, "You know," he said, "I had a lot of experience before I wrote that Education for Life book." And I looked at him and he said, "Yeah," he says, "I went to a lot of schools." And he did, when you think about it. He had exposure to a lot of systems, but mostly he had exposure to Master, right? And he had his own soul development, which allowed him to, even before he came on this path, understand that the goal of life is infinite. And that's what happens when you're with him. And that's what happens when you read the book. You know, that light that comes from his consciousness emanates from that book. That's what happens when he walks into a room. He kept saying, "I just want to mingle." He'd walk into the room. All the Indian devotees would stop what they were doing. They would go like this. They would just stand there and drink in his very presence. They knew that they were in the presence of a saint. It's really something. Now, he knows who each one of you are. I know that because when I gave him the little promo piece that we had done most recently for the school, and the children had sent him a book with letters and artwork and cards that they had created. And he very carefully went through each page. And he put it on the coffee table. And he, when anybody came in, he says, "Oh, look at that." You know. And he would say on the promo piece, "Who's this?" And when one of the teachers, Therese, is new this year, he said, "Who's that?" And I would say, and he'd want to know. He want to know everybody that he didn't recognize. And he has the capacity to take it in and never forget it. He knows names. He knows consciousness. So for those of us who can't always be in His presence, we have the capability, because He is such a tremendous receiving station, of connecting with Him. All we have to do is send out the blessing, and He'll receive it. We can bless Him. That's a wonderful spiritual practice. And then stand and receive the blessings back that comes from that. And that's what I wish for all of you.